Hi, everybody. Welcome to the December call. Holy cow, what a month. My goodness, the first bipartisan climate pricing bill in almost a decade. We know introducing a bill is not the same thing as passing, but it's the first significant step, and it's a really, really important moment for all of the work that you've been doing. Remarkable, remarkable. Thank you for your incredible work. So what are we going to do today? Well, we're going to do what we do. I'm going to be introducing our speaker in just a moment. We'll go over what happened since last month's call. And then most importantly, we'll get into what we want you to do, which is the most important thing for this month. So one of the things that I hope that happens in your chapter is I hope you get to go around and talk about what happened in that moment when you heard the bill drop. We did this exercise in the staff and it was kind of electric, just hearing what people's thoughts were, who they talked to, when they heard it, where they were, and I recommend you do that with your chapter. One of the things that happens in my life that makes my life kind of, you know, special, like I want to pinch myself, is I regularly get notes from you, or I get calls from you, or I get texts saying, would you like to talk to this person? So they'll say, do you want to talk to Larry Summers? Yes, I would like to talk to Larry Summers. Would you like to talk to Naomi Klein? I would love to talk to Naomi Klein. About 5 years ago, I got a call saying, I have a connection to Howard Dean. Would you like to talk to Howard Dean? Yes, I would like to talk to Howard Dean. You know, former Democratic governor of Vermont, former head of the DNC, a viable candidate for president. And we were talking. And I was explaining to him what we were out to do, getting a bipartisan climate bill with a transparent price on carbon. And he said to me these words, you will never do it. It's impossible. You will never do it. It's impossible. Now, people tell me that a lot. So I listen to them and I'm polite and I don't tell them they're crazy or anything. But what I thought to hit myself was, you don't know my people. My people eat impossible for breakfast. If there's anybody that will do this, it's my people. So anyway, thank you. I'm sure you all have people who told you similar things, and I just wanted to share that one with you. Okay, so our guest today is someone we've actually wanted on the call for quite a while. Per Espen Stoknes is a Norwegian psychologist and politician for the Green Party who served as a deputy representative to the Parliament of Norway. He weaves together psychology and economics in imaginative ways, often revolving around the human relationship to the natural world and to each other. He's the author of the book, What We Think About When We Try Not to Think About Global Warming. Stoknes posits that people have five inner defenses that stop them from engaging on climate change, and he offers ways to flip those defenses. I thought that's something that you and I would be really interested in. And welcome on a Saturday night from Norway, Mr. Stoknes.
I must say, calling in early and listening to all the different chapters joining and the cheers and the conversation so far makes me in a very good mood. I'm already impressed by the climate citizens lobby and what happened in Canada, creating more and more momentum. So since I only have like 12 minutes, I'll do a short version of the main findings in my research and the book you mentioned, and also the TED talk that I've done, where you can also refine some of these main issues. So that's one shot on the TED talk. Now, the challenge here is that for about the last 28 years, almost 30 years, climate change communications have mostly been done in two main approaches. The first, of course, is from the scientists themselves, in terms of giving people the facts, giving the information. So we've heard stuff like, in order to reach the 2-degree target for 2100, which is the Paris Agreement, the remaining carbon budget is only 800 gigatons to keep the CO2 below the critical level of 450 ppm. This way of communicating is called, in my version, scientism. It's based on the information deficit approach, believing that if only you get the facts across, people will get engaged and change their behavior and their attitudes. since that didn't work, the other way of doing it has been through what we could call doomism. And we've had both this autumn in another go, in the same way that we've had in climate communications over the last 28 years. Doomism is when we speak about if we continue this way, we'll soon live in a world where there's crazy wildfires killing us, amazing, devastating floods, killer storms and droughts. And if we don't change in just two or few years and start cutting emissions dramatically, we'll soon live in a boiling earth, a hellhole. So why don't these two ways of communicating, either doomism or scientism, really get people engaged? And this is where psychology comes in. I'm not saying that it's wrong that we're on the approach to catastrophe or very difficult climate situation. I'm not saying that the facts are wrong. I'm just saying that this approach to the human psyche has been proven ineffectual. So the reason is that we have certain psychological barriers inside. I like to kind of put it this way, that the greatest barrier to solving climate change is about 6 inches thick. It's the space between our ears. Because the solution is obvious and the climate citizens lobby is working for it. We put a proper price on carbon. We give the money back to everybody, particularly educate women. And then we roll this out with tax border adjustments. Now, why doesn't this work properly? Even though we know the problem, we've described it in facts and with catastrophic implications, people still don't seem to get it. And the reasons are that when climate news comes going, it has activated these five inner barriers. And the first barrier is, so what, for instance, is climate news, just to mention that. Well, it could be like, did you know that we just passed the 410 ppm CO2 atmospheric concentration threshold? Now, giving people those kind of climate news is insufficient. And the first barrier that is erected with this is that climate as an issue tends to generate psychological distancing. Scientists speak about the year 2100, so that's distance in time. There's distance in space. There have been lots of glacier iconography and polar bears, etc. It's also distant in terms of impact. It seemed to hit people, poor people in particular, far away from where I live. And it's also outside my scope of influence. Whatever I do, it doesn't really make a dent. So I can't really do anything about it. So people then retreat behind this distancing and focus on nearer things, such as, you know, how many Facebook likes you get on a post, or your job, or how your children is doing. And this is perfectly understandable. It's just how the human brain works. And we need to acknowledge that these barriers are there. The second barrier is the doom barrier, that I previously mentioned a little bit. It has to do with that overuse of the disaster framings when you speak about climate change. One study by Oxford Institute of Journalism found that more than 80% of all climate news articles had employed the disaster frame, meaning that if we continue as today, we're all going to hell. I'll skip that very quickly. The next is the dissonance barrier. It's like cognitive dissonance is what happens when there's a conflict inside me between what I know. I've heard the climate news, but still I'm stuck in the previous century kind of behavior and infrastructure. So I have to drive my car, I have to fly to visit my family. We all eat meat together. So because society is stuck in the 19th century systems, and we now have 21st century knowledge about the climate, these things create an inner conflict. But then this dissonance is usually resolved by self-justifications. So I say, for instance, that my neighbor, he has a bigger car than I do, or the Chinese, they have launching another coal plant every week. It doesn't matter what we do. I could also embrace doubt. I could say, for instance, well, you know, climate is always changing, or I think maybe it's the solar activity. I heard physicists say that. If I believe them, then the dissonance goes away. So I get an immediate psychological benefit from disbelieving climate science. The fourth barrier psychology has identified, and these are main findings from about like 300-400 psychological research papers, is of course denial, which has been used a lot in the public debate, but not in a very psychologically precise manner. It's been used mainly as a derogative, kind of pointing the finger to the other camp, which are in denial, implying that they are either ignorant, haven't understood it, lacking knowledge, or simply plain evil. Denial, however, is something else. It's a case when we are both have knowledge, and with them we have to live as if we do not know it. So it's a kind of double life, where maybe I know the climate science news on Thursday, but by Monday morning or by Tuesday morning, I live again as if I never knew. And particularly, I won't raise the subject too often because I have colleagues or family that agree not to speak about it. So this denial is based on a social contract. The fifth barrier is identity. Now, when climate activists speak out about the climate, typically they've been calling for more taxes, more regulations, more interventionist government. And if then people with conservative values or conservative / free market ideology identity hears this, then because they don't like the implications, more regulations, bigger government, kind of smaller cars, bigger government, that's the wrong way around. It should be big cars and small government. Then the climate science itself must be wrong. So this is well known in psychology. It's the confirmation bias. I filter out news and facts that conflict with my values, that threaten my sense of self-identity. And then I will use all my intelligence, my knowledge, and creativity in order to explain away the science. So if you will, put it this way, identity trumps truth any day. So based on these five barriers, climate communications, unfortunately, with the best intention, still have been rather unproductive. What do we know from the science of what really works? And when I did review all these 300-400 articles, I also found lots of studies that empirically demonstrated what actually creates engagement. And first, what we do know is that social aspects is very core to the human animal's mind, so to speak. We are all evolutionary flock animals going way back. So I care a lot more about what my friends, what my neighbors, what my colleagues are doing, rather than what some kind of scientific egghead is expressing or some kind of policy wonk. So when people around me do something, such as shown in this picture, where my neighbor gets solar panels on the roof, this is not just electricity, it's also a social signal that climate change, the new energy system, is here, it's near, it's urgent, and it's personal. So we flip the distance barrier by pointing out what our neighbors are doing. And in Norway, The second is that rather than repeating the doom barrier, the disaster perspective, we should have three supportive framings for each one threat we have. So we could speak more about all the healthy opportunities and the connections that health and climate have in common. This is not meat, it's a plant-based burger. The blood there, which I can really dig into my teeth, enjoying it, and my tongue. It's all from red beet, along with some gastronomic advanced additives. So it feels like blood. It's perfect replacement. It's better for my body, it's better for climate, and it's better for the animals. These are more supportive framings, and also we should speak more about all the jobs. Recently, we passed the 10 million mark on the new renewable energy jobs. And these are supportive framings because they trigger the happiness or the pleasure centers in the brain rather than triggering cost, doom, and sacrifice, which the doom barrier tends to do. Then we should approach behaviors to make it more simple to act climate friendly. Today, that's kind of difficult. It's hard to know which car is the better, which appliance, the air conditioner is better than the other. And we should rearrange all of our consumer choices so that the default becomes climate friendly. For instance, if I'm at the buffet and there's a large plate as shown on the left, it shows, at least left to me, left side on the picture, it shows that the plate is half empty. So most people would then put more food on it, but they won't eat it. So that generates extra food waste. Now, if we change to a smaller plate, the same amount of food which a typical person eats makes the plate look full, and people stop taking food there. And this simple nudge, as it's called, has demonstrated to reduce food waste in restaurants, buffets, everywhere, with 20%, more than 20%, compared to if you ask people to not take more food than you need, that's 0.5%. So by rearranging the choice architecture, we make it simple for people to get out of their dissonance. So we break that barrier. Fourth, we need to give feedback to people on how well we're doing. Climate scientists have been speaking too much about CO2 in gigatons and PPM levels. It's hard to do something with that, but if I get to know how many people have been biking into my city, how many people have been changing their behavior recently, and I can see that my company, my family, this is an app that logs individual actions, such as reduce food waste, have a vegetarian day, buy local vegetables. And when this is done, it can add up all these to what is done as a team and what's done as a community, a city, a company. And this way you get a feeling that we're together on this and we're making progress, which is incredibly important to keep up the psychological motivation levels. Finally, there is the story. We need better stories about which kind of societies we want that are non-polarizing. So what does a better low emission society look like? We need to envision that, and we need to get also personal stories about the people who are creating this. So for instance, in Oslo, this is a lady called Christina Bu. She heads the Electric Car Association, and she's been fighting every day for the last 5 years against all the prejudices, all the kind of ridicule she gets because of electric cars. And now Oslo has turned around. We're electrifying all cars. Half of all cars sold in Norway now are electric. The buses are going electric. People are going electric bikes. So it's an electrifying story that people like to bring home and tell their neighbor about how cool driving this electric vehicle is. And that brings us full cycle back to the social aspect. And these five principles, these five solutions, social, simple, supportive, signal, and story, sum up a lot of the status now about how the, so it was a bleeding edge of climate change communication is heading. And luckily, thousands of innovative climate change communicators are now shifting around, not because of me or this model, but because this is more and more well documented. We see the effects of this. And if we continue this change that I've observed just the last 4 to 5 years, I'm certain that we'll soon have more success stories like the one we have from Canada. One of the slides I didn't have the time to show was a slide from showing the map of Oslo, where two psychology students that I supervised this summer completed their thesis, and they analyzed all the EV, electric vehicle purchases in Oslo to see if there was a clustering. So if one person in the street got an electric car, would that increase the likelihood of another person in the same street getting the car? And also the opposite dynamic. If there is nobody with an electric car, what's the frequency of the people in this street getting electric cars? And it turned out it's incredibly effective. So if it was kind of average, everything should have been gray, but the red roads in their graphic were all streets where there is a strong neighborhood effect of one person getting an electric car, then the next, within 2 years, there are more of very close. And then opposite, in those areas of Oslo where there is no electric car, then the neighbors won't get it either. So you see this very powerful dynamic playing out. And I think this is incredibly important, not because it solves climate change as such, but because it builds this bottom-up support we need to press the policy solutions that can solve climate change.
Okay, I have a question for you. So one thing that changed our organization is in 2011, we first saw Rob Willard's paper, Apocalypse Soon, Dire Messaging is Counterproductive on Global Warming. And that his study showed, like you, the studies you've studied, that you have to lead with success, you have to lead with solutions. And then I get a lot of concern from our membership is, are we expressing the, you know, the urgency enough? You know, the reports keep coming out, you know, right now it's not just month after month, it's week after week of holy cow, you know, things are way worse. So how do you balance knowing how urgent it is, but then also knowing that you have to communicate in a way that's actually effective at moving people along?
Very good question. The approach that seems to me best founded in psychology research is this, what I have on the screen there. If you can see the framing, so 3-2-1. It's based on a lot of research going on the positivity ratio. Started out with experiments in the lab where they had teams of people watching apocalyptic, very kind of horror movies, very threatening stuff. And then afterwards, they had them solve problems that required collaboration and creativity. Now, one group that watched the horror or the threat or the apocalypse movies, then that was compared to another group that watched more comedy or, shall we say, stories that were personal and ended well. The third group just watched more or less boring documentaries. The results show very clearly that when the movies had a 3-1 positivity balance, the number of suggested solutions, the number of interactions, the social interactions in the team, and the number of times, the time they needed to solve those problems were much better than those that had watched the apocalyptic movies. So there seems to be a requirement for human flourishing, not just on this one experiment, but a lot of them, that in order to flourish, humans need to know the urgency. Yes, there is an urgent threat. Climate change is alarming. And these are things that are positive. These are things that are possible. These are things that will make your life and our lives better. And if that seems feasible, then people will go for it. And that's why I love the Drawdown Project with Paul Hawken, with the 100 solutions, and how that, if we scale those up, that's an abundance of solutions. And if we scale those up, we can actually reverse global warming profitably within 20, 30 years.
Great. So, Sarah, I can see about 30 questions came in since the last pause. Is there one you want to pick from there?
Yeah. Somebody asked how politicians fit into this model.
That's a good question. I think communicating to politicians is all about showing their possible advantages in terms of positioning themselves. Politicians are somehow, but many people expected to lead, that we expect politicians to go ahead and show where we want to go. That's, of course, a wrong model. Politicians don't lead. They scan current changes, and then they attempt to hit those waves. So, for instance, here is Norway, to use one example. We had a whale 1.5 years back, a sea whale, beautiful 50-foot animal, come up, and it died on the shore. People tried to chase it out, but they didn't. It just went back. And then when it was opened up after it died. It had 30 plastic bags in its stomach. That was a major kind of media thing happening in Norway. And then everybody got aware of the plastic pollution problem. And we had lots of TV programs. There were lots of people are speaking everywhere about this thing. And then we saw all the political parties, right, left, center, put plastic on top of their speaking agenda. So the minute there is a public wave of concern or attention, politicians are there to tap into it. But they're always working from behind, watching what's happening, watching the level of people, the amount of people who are saying that climate change is a high concern, and maybe also the solutions, the necessary pushing for those solutions. If a lot of people seem to support the solutions, like renewable energy, hopefully soon cap and dividend, then the politician will jump on the wagon.
Great. Well, thank you so much. This is extremely useful for our people. We all live, breathe, and die for climate change, and we might have a few other interests and a few other hobbies, but this is what we live for. This is what we're always looking for, to we can be more effective. And, you know, maybe we can have you back for a Q&A sometime for additional questions, because there's now about 40 questions in the queue that we're just not going to get to. Thank you so much for making yourself available on a Saturday evening in Norway. We really, really appreciate it.
Great being with you. And I'm a truly huge fan of the Climate Citizens Lobby. I wish we had more of them in Norway.
Yes, so do we. So do we. And you're welcome to stay on. We have about 10 or 15 more minutes of stuff. You're welcome to stay on. But if you know, you have other things to do this evening, we certainly will recognize that also. Good. Well, let's first of all, let's go over what happened since last month's call. So usually what I do is give you an inventory. We got this many op-eds. We got this many letters to the editor. We had this many meetings with members of Congress. We had this many outreach events. We had this many personal letters. But we have one category that I never report on. One of the categories we report on is bills introduced. And for the first time in the 9.5 years that I've been here, it's bills introduced one. So that's a big day. So that's the only one I'm going to report on. We're having a phenomenal month on letters to the editor. Just so you know, we had a phenomenal month last month. But I thought that that's just a good one data point to report. I also want to mention that there's been a challenge issued. Is the most letters to the editor we got ever was 420. But anyway, so we're shooting for 421 letters to the editor. There have been already 600 submitted this month. Now, it's not 600 published, but 600 submitted. So we know people are submitting a lot, and thank you, and keep going for that. I do want to talk about what we're doing in Canada and the U.S. mostly this month, because it's such an important month. In Canada, just like in the U.S., we're focused on our year-end appeal, so everything you can do, Canadians, to support that, it'd be really, really appreciated. In the U.S., in your action sheet, you'll see, first of all, there is a lot of activity to support the introduction of the bill. And that's all laid out in the action sheet, and we've been going over that in all the different calls we've been doing. So I think that's very crystal clear and laid out clearly. I want to talk about the lead up to a week ago Tuesday when the bill dropped. So we have been working on language for a year and a half. And starting in about March, we were pretty sure a bill was about to be dropped. And then time after time, it would be, we're almost there, and Lucy pulled the football one more time and we fell on our back. Well, finally, 2 weeks ago, we knew that the bill was going to drop on a Thursday. And so we were all set, we had organized everything, and what happened is on Sunday, it started to leak out to the press. We'd had bets internally whether things would leak or whether we would get to Thursday. The people who voted that it would leak won those bets. And so all of a sudden, we hear from Mr. Deutsch's office, we're introducing on Tuesday. So on Tuesday, Danny Richter is on an airplane flying back to the East Coast when the bill drops. Nevertheless, so Danny's very much at the heart of the matter for everything we do there. Within minutes, the website was up with our bill. Within minutes, the all supporter email went out. Within minutes, there was a text to all the regional coordinators. Within minutes, there was an email to the entire staff supporting everybody saying, here's what we're doing. And so just to remind you, here's what the website looked that went live the moment that that bill dropped. Yeah, the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act. And so I really think America's Climate Solutions, I really strongly recommend you don't use acronyms, but you actually use the actual name of the bill. If you know the enormous amount of work that the staff did to have this ready so that the minute a bill dropped, we could be working on this, having it be effective. And now what you'll see is when you click on that, you'll see all the statements, the public statements from other NGOs, other people, media companies are all there now, and that's live, so you can see that also. Then we listed out five things we like about the bill. You can see some of those now. The first thing we like is it's effective. And this policy is the most aggressive, most comprehensive policy ever introduced in the U.S. Congress. It's far more aggressive than the Clean Power Plan. It's far more aggressive than our Paris goals. And there's accelerators if we are not meeting our objectives. Second, it's good for people. Because the air is cleaner, people's health is going to be way better. It's going to save lives. A lot less people are going to be sick. And then also, it's going to put money in the pockets of people could use having money in their pockets. One of the things we started toying with a couple years ago is, could we get people their first check a month ahead of the bill actually starting? And we were actually able to get that language into this version of the bill. So what that would mean is for people at the lower end of the economic spectrum, who increase in costs might hurt, they would have the check in advance. And for people who are skeptical that the government wouldn't actually return the money to households, the money would actually go back to them, and it would be a huge goodwill gesture. It's good for the economy. We know that if we take hundreds of billions of dollars and give it to people who actually spend money, the potential stimulative effect where it has the chance to increase jobs throughout the economic spendery, helping to bring the clean energy economy, that it's good for the economy. And then I love that it's bipartisan, because I'm sure you read as many stories as I do and watch the shows and people talk about how this is the worst it's ever been and everybody's so tribal and it's impossible and how could you ever get anybody to work with anybody? And oh, our bill's bipartisan. I think that that's one of our really important selling points. And I think that that's why it is so important that we've got a marker out now for the next Congress and the House and Senate to say, this is the bipartisan way forward. There's a bipartisan way forward. And this bill is bipartisan. First bipartisan climate pricing goal in just about a decade. And then the last is it's revenue neutral. It does not grow government. It pays for its own costs, and then the rest of the money is distributed equally to American households. Okay, so I want to talk about now the $1 million match. We are in the middle of the biggest financial opportunity we've ever had for this organization. And where we basically are is at 45%. So we've raised just a little bit over $450,000. We have $1 million match. This is 2 weeks into the campaign, so we've got till the end of the year. And we want to push this thing really, really hard from now to the end of the year. And I just wanted to point to those things that happened with the website and everything that got done to understand the kind of extraordinary work that your staff has done to do this. And if you run into any of them lately, and they look a little bit ragged around the edges, it's because they're a little bit ragged around the edges. You know, the workload is usually pretty intense. And then to add on top of this, everything that had to do to roll the bill out, and they worked flawlessly. And working with them was such a privilege, watching people do extraordinary work and essentially not get on each other's nerves very much. Okay, so I want to tell you some of the things people are doing to support the $1 million goal. Because again, this is the biggest financial opportunity CCL's ever had. One is, so we have 100 climate guardians, right? These are people who committed $10,000 themselves to create the $1 million match. And some of them have challenged their friends and families to match their donation. And some of them have already exceeded their $10,000. So I thought that was pretty exciting and fun. Some of our chapters have taken on being climate champions. So they said our chapter is going to match one of the climate guardians' $10,000 donation. If that works, if that's fun, if that's exciting for your chapter, I recommend it. Please don't feel burdened or like anybody would have to do something like that. Then let's not forget Steve Gann. Steve Gann is a group leader in Washington State. What he did to become a climate champion is he walked the Pacific Coast Trail. And he asked a bunch of us to just donate a few cents per mile as he walked the entire Pacific Coast Trail. I was really honored to have Steve ask me to be one of those people that participated in his match, and really super happy when I was able actually to put that donation in to be part of Steve Gann's creating his Climate Guardian amount by walking the entire Pacific Coast Trail. And I want to make sure that if any of you were not on the launch call, I want to remind you a couple of things that Danny Richter said on that call. One is we did a launch call the night the bill dropped. We did two calls. One is he reminded us that the people who introduced the bill in the House are committed to introducing a bill in the new Congress. And also that as an organization, our goal is by the June conference, there's a companion bill in the Senate. So our goal is by the time we get back to Washington, D.C. in June, we've got bills in play in both the House and Senate, which would certainly be a really, really fun way for all of us to be on Capitol Hill, in my view. Okay, last thing is this. We are an organization that are really big fans of handwritten notes. I would bet most of the people on this call have written people handwritten notes. You've written members of Congress handwritten notes. You've written members of their staff's handwritten notes. You've written each other handwritten notes. I've gotten thousands of handwritten notes from you over the years, and it's always really touching to me because I think there's something about it that just says a little bit more about people's commitment, about making this personal, that adds a certain element to the note. And what I'd like to do is read you a handwritten note that was written on January 20th, 1993. And it says, "Dear Bill, when I walked into this office just now, I felt the same sense of wonder and respect that I felt 4 years ago. I know that you will feel that too. I wish you great happiness here. I never felt the loneliness some presidents have described. There will be very tough times, made even more difficult by criticism you may not think is fair. I'm not a very good one to give advice, but just don't let the critics discourage you or push you off course. You will be underlined our president when you read this note. I wish you well. I wish your family well. Your success is now our country's success. I'm rooting hard for you. Good luck, George." That was George H.W. Bush's note to Bill Clinton on January 20th as he left the Oval Office. Okay, Sarah's going to unmute everybody's line so we can all sign off. What a month, everybody, huh? Great work. Keep up the great work. Let's keep pushing. It was such an important month for us, and thank you all for all you're doing. Bye, everybody.